I am 18. 29th of April 1971 to the 28th of April 1972. Above. Change Them Yourself by Giles H. Brown. I was 18 on the 29th of April 1971. This event, as with many young men, made me feel grown, yet still tied to the boy I had been for the preceding years of my existence. Too young to be crushed by existential thoughts of transience and death, I opened my mind to creative stimuli and the development of a personal understanding of success and reward in whatever my adulthood might look like. But how might success be achieved? And what does reward look like? What are the measures of life well lived? Questions, questions, questions. As is common with youth, I looked to break the shackles of geography and upbringing. I'd moved with family from Butterworth in the Eastern Cape Province to Newton Stewart in Galloway, to Corby in Northamptonshire, following ministry and the migration of steelworkers from Scotland to Little Scotland. However, unlike those Scots who had travelled before me seeking employment and pay, my inclination in those early years was to stay local and keep my head down. Never stand out in a crowd. Fearful, perhaps, of the world beyond, or perhaps I felt I had travelled enough during the preceding 18 years. I therefore looked not to travel to break free, but within to expose my mind to new things, new to me, and new to the dour, beige, Austin Maxi world of the early 1970s. Of course, this strategy had its limitations, as one cannot know everything, see everything, hear everything, touch everything, experience everything. It also meant I had to travel, as Corby was certainly not the centre of the philosophical thought, artistic endeavour, musical invention, despite Steel Town by Big Country, and philanthropic public art galleries. And while the postal workers were on strike, at least British Rail were connecting me to places, clipped card ticket in hand, player's navy cut lit in the smoking compartment. It was difficult to feel liberated then, as the Briton passing by felt depressed, visually and mentally. Indeed, 1971 signalled the future direction of British politics when the then Education Secretary, Margaret Hilda Thatcher, ended free school milk for children over seven. But once my destination's other worlds opened up, closing down reality to imagination, driven by previously unseen and unheard stimuli. A world within a world. A world within the world. My young mind took me in the direction of art, which seemed cerebral at the time, and music, which satisfied a more direct hedonism. The cerebral aspects of which were less of a concern at the moment, both of which were an exciting juncture in their evolution in the very early 1970s. Imagine hearing Electric Warrior for the first time in September 1971, or Led Zeppelin 4 in November, or buying Miles Davis' Live Evil and trying to contextualise it in the history of jazz that had gone before. Imagine seeing Led Zeppelin or a pre-Dark Side of the Moon Pink Floyd being immersed in a Grateful Dead show, or seeing Frank Zappa, who appeared like an alien on these shores. At the start of my 18-year-old oral explorations, I found David Bowie boring. But with hindsight, that was because he was like me, evolving. Hunky Dory, released in December 1971, did, and still does, sound quaint in places. The demos and the bootlegs attest to this further, highlighting a variety of styles and avenues being tried, explored, rejected and developed further. However, by the time I got to art college, he had morphed into Ziggy Stardust, and his persona was an integral part of, rather than being an adjunct to, his music. He had become something else, something daring and disruptive, something to bear in mind later on, I thought. I soaked up art both in the mind and visually via books and exhibitions. Serious art criticism was even fed to the prime-time viewing public by John Berger, flares and wing collars distracting only slightly from opening us up to seeing better, of deciphering meaning through the modern three-channel, usually black-and-white medium. I loved Rembrandt Harmazoon van Rijn, Edgar Degas, and Joseph Mallard William Turner, whose works were accessible in a conservative British art establishment and well represented in UK galleries. Great painters whose technique was manifest in front of me, available for interrogation and education and sheer awe, in addition to the subjects and emotions they conveyed in two dimensions. Plus, the galleries were free to access, a very important consideration when the ambit of my idealism and self-directed cultural education did not extend as far as effective income generation, and hence physical sustenance and quality shelter. Not that I shied away from a range of jobs so varied that I realised I could turn my hand to anything, as long as it didn't start too late in the morning or require too much loyalty or a uniform. My scrutiny of these accepted masters was somewhat undermined with no little sense of irony. The year I dedicated my life to painting was also the year I went to the Andy Warhol retrospective at the Tate. Here was an artist as artwork, an artist trying to decouple the hand from the medium, to automate, replicate and become a machine, after Ford perhaps, the best example of the influence of industrialization on the world. Like Zappa, another alien from America breaking down the walls of the establishment in Britain. Pink, not fawn. Screen print, not oil. Soup, not sunsets. The antithesis of my previously accepted painterly guides. And a hint, perhaps, of my as yet unenvisaged future in music and music video. Sample, reorder, reimagine, represent orally and present visually through the future MTV medium. Perhaps my 18th year really was the genesis of my future. To quote, they say that time changes things, but you actually have to change them yourself. Andy Warhol. Rule 1, find your deepest poverty. Rule 2, find your inner outsider, and then the journey begins. The elderly gentleman, and onwards into my 19th year.
Below. Dear British Ski Jumping Olympic Committee, by Luisella Matza. Dear British Ski Jumping Olympic Committee, my name is William Drummond, and I'd like to apply to participate in the upcoming Winter Olympics in Sapporo, Japan. You may wonder why I would make an excellent candidate for your team, even if you've never heard of me. I've been a proficient ski jumper since the age of 10. My personal record includes jumping from the roof of my parents' house in 1963 and successfully landing on the lower end of the scaffolding, which I had climbed earlier. Both my siblings, a bunch of neighbours, the firemen and my dog witnessed the jump, and they were all tremendously impressed. My parents, particularly my mother, were so impressed that they couldn't stop crying. I can assure you that none of these people, particularly my dog, are easy to impress. To this day, my mother still cries and shakes her head in disbelief when this episode comes up, typically at Christmas. As you know, the games will begin on February 3rd, 1972, precisely 100 days from now. Therefore, I understand that I am well in time for a trial, should you require one. However, I can guarantee that there is absolutely no need to worry about my proficiency. I am equally at home with any of the sports disciplines, although I do have a small preference for large hill, i.e. jumping over 300 feet. Thank you for your consideration and look forward to hearing from you. Yours sincerely, William Drummond. 20 November 1971. Dear British Ski Jumping Olympic Committee, my name is William Drummond and I am writing to follow up on my letter of application to your ski jumping team for the Winter Olympic Games coming up in precisely 75 days. Having received no response from yourselves, I wonder if there is an explanation for your silence. Maybe you doubt my ski jumping skills. I can well understand that, given that you may have never heard of me. However, I can promise that I'll make an excellent team member. In fact, despite your silence, I've been religiously keeping up with my ski jumping practice. Only just last week, I climbed up the hills of Sherlock Pike, Northumberland, carrying my skis on my back all the way to the top. Unfortunately, the lack of snow meant that I could not perform any ski jumping, but then again, I successfully completed half of the job as I did jump, leaning forward, feet together, skis tied to my back, all the way to the bottom. I received multiple silent looks of admiration from the many who watched me pass by. I shall have more luck in finding more suitable snowy conditions on my trip to Wanlockhead, Scotland, in the next few days. I shall send you an update of my latest records then. Awaiting your response, yours sincerely, William Drummond. 15 December 1971. Dear British Ski Jumping Olympic Committee, my name is William Drummond and I am writing to provide you with an update on my application to join the British Ski Jumping team for the Winter Olympic Games coming up in precisely 50 days. As anticipated, my trip to Wanlockhead has been extraordinarily successful. I found the place covered in snow, the ideal conditions to perfect my outstanding ski jumping skills. On the day after my arrival, I set off to climb the Lowther Hill radar station, a perfect location to jump from. In fact, you may want to consider the place for your team's regular practice. In the deepest quiet of the early morning hours, I climbed the rooftop of the radar station. Having donned my skis, I sped down the roof and onto the hill in one long, elegant swoop. Sadly, there were no witnesses to this amazing achievement, but I can assure you it was the most impressive, most beautiful jump off a radar station ever performed. I trust there is no need for further evidence to confirm the strength of my application. However, should you ever need any, you're welcome to speak to Mrs. Kathleen Duncan, landlady at the Wanlockhead Inn, who called me the greatest ski jumper that Wanlockhead has ever seen. So impressed was she that she has arranged for a small gathering of locals to take place tomorrow at the bottom of the hill, where I shall land successfully after my second jump. Awaiting your response, yours sincerely, William Drummond. P.S. Should the reason for your silence be my preference to be drafted for the large hill, feel free to ignore it. I am equally happy to do my bit in any discipline you see fit to enter me for. 19 December 1971. Dear British Ski Jumping Olympic Committee, as we approach the Christmas holidays, please accept my best wishes for the season. I am attaching a copy of an article from the Wanlockhead Gazette. It covers my second extraordinary radar station jump, which I successfully performed in front of the cheering local crowds yesterday. My favourite quote is highlighted in yellow. A new star is born for Britain's Olympic team. William Drummond. I hope you won't mind that I presented my selection for the team as a fait accompli, but I'm sure I'll hear from you soon with all the details of my participation in the Games, now just 45 days away. Looking forward to meeting and discussing in detail at your earliest convenience. Yours sincerely, William Drummond. 24 January 1972. Dear British Ski Jumping Olympic Committee, this is your last opportunity. The Olympic Games begin in just 10 days. Awaiting your urgent response, William Drummond. 10 February 1972. Dear British Ski Jumping Olympic Committee, I am now convinced that this must be a terrible misunderstanding. However, to remove any ambiguity, I have made my own way to Sapporo. You'll find me at the entrance to the ski jumping arena tomorrow before the competition starts. Please note that I'd like to compete with bib number 23. See you tomorrow, William Drummond.
A Troubled Dream. I Love My Milk Float by Dave Mankind. After doing my foundation course at the art school in Northampton in the early 1970s, at the age of 19, I started my first proper full-time job working as a milkman. I never had a problem getting up early because it meant I could spend the rest of the day in bed, reading and smoking after my shift. And as long as I could get myself to sleep by 10 in the evening, I'd be rested enough for the early start. The quiet mornings with no one around suited my nature, and more importantly, I'd be working by myself. A few months into the job, I turned up for work one Saturday morning, still tripping from the night before, after dropping several tabs of acid. Near the end of my shift, an overweight 40-something customer called Mrs. Vine invited me inside when she went looking for money to pay her bill. Feeling a little nauseous, I took a seat in the warm kitchen to steady myself as I waited. My eyes became transfixed on the pattern of the checkered linoleum beneath my feet. Its squares expanding outward like some endless chessboard into another dimension. After what seemed like an eternity, but was probably only a few minutes, she reappeared. Before my eyes, she had shapeshifted into the form of a cow. As I turned away in the shock from the insane hallucination before me, I could see my milk float parked down the street through the window. The bottles were all shattered, their contents leaking and pulling onto the black tarmac below. I fell backwards and collapsed. That afternoon, after returning home, I fell into a deep sleep, and for the first time in a while, a troubling recurring dream that I'd had many times since I was a child came back to me. But this time, more intense than it had ever been. In this dream, I no longer feel human. I have a much larger centre of gravity, and I'm low to the ground, suffering from an overwhelming sense of claustrophobia and trapped in a confined space with all my limbs restrained. I attempt to call out, but my vocal cords can no longer form words, only plaintive moans. Unable to open my mouth, my head feels as if it's tied with some kind of halter, increasing the sensation of suffocation and breathlessness. At the height of my distress, caught in a state of sleep paralysis, I become aware of the threatening presence of one or several dark figures standing by the bed. Face down and unable to move, I feel something enter my body with extreme force, violating me over and over, the cycles of fear and panic in me rising to a frightful climax. Afterwards, I awake, sweating profusely with an earthy, sickly sweet taste in my mouth, which is often followed by bouts of diarrhea and vomiting. I began to live in fear of the dream and would spend long nights staring at the bedroom ceiling, trying to stay awake, often turning up for work the following morning, having had no sleep at all. This went on for a few weeks, with the dream occurring with an increasing frequency until I became mentally exhausted and insane with tiredness. On the morning of November 5th, crazed with sleep deprivation, I collected the milk float from the depot and set off in the opposite direction to my usual route, heading instead towards Findentop Lodge Quarry, some 10 miles or so away. Once I arrived, I drove to the uppermost part of the quarry and parked the float. After a few moments of sitting in silence, I released the handbrake and made my way around to the back of the vehicle. I began pushing it slowly, gradually building up speed until it finally rolled off the edge and down into the waters below. The next day, I decided to leave Northampton and head north to Liverpool. I never suffered the troubling dream again.